Shrink Wrap Radio Number 398, A Plan for Long-Term Life Satisfaction, with Dr. Tobin Hart.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is Dr. Tobin Hart, psychologist and professor, whom I interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 89 on the secret spiritual world of children way back in 2007. Today, we are discussing his latest book titled The Four Virtues. For more detail on Dr. Hart, please go to the show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Tobin Hart, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David.
It's been 7 years, hard to believe, since our interview about your book on the spirituality of children. And even though it's been a long time and I've done more than 300 interviews since then, that one still stands out in my memory as one of my all-time favorites. So when I heard about your new book, I was eager to get you back on the show here.
Thanks. Nice to be back with you. I appreciate it. I remember the previous interview because so well because you really grasped things beautifully. I just really appreciated that a lot. So I was happy to come back with you.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, we have a kind of kinship because I was at Sonoma State University for all of my academic career. I retired, actually. It's hard to believe, but I think it's been maybe 9 years. And you were at West Georgia. Is it West Georgia State College or did it become West Georgia University? And are you still there?
Yes, at the University of West Georgia.
University of West Georgia.
Mm-hmm. And have been here. My wife and I moved down to Georgia from Amherst, Massachusetts when my youngest daughter was, my oldest daughter was 10 days old. And we thought we'd stay for a year or two, and it's been 20 years, so.
Oh, okay. Wow, I know how that happens. And Sonoma State, you know, had kind of planted a flag in humanistic psychology and to some extent transpersonal psychology, and that, I think, was a heritage that was kind of shared. West Georgia was the only other place in the country that had done kind of the same thing, I think in both cases as a result of a student of Maslow.
We've graduated now several of our students who've gone on to teach elsewhere, so we absolutely we're proud of our heritage and our horizon too.
Well, that's good for you and good that you've been able to preserve it over this period of time, because there were various forces gnawing away at our program.
Absolutely. For some reason, people haven't, you know, we've been a little bit under the radar, and I think that's that helps when you're at a program out in the country a little bit and
yes,
off the beaten path. That's people haven't paid too much attention to us, which really has been great for us. It's enabled us to survive.
Yeah, under the radar is good.
Yeah.
Now, the title of your latest book is The Four Virtues. And virtues, the word virtues in some ways strikes me as an old-fashioned word, maybe an old-fashioned concept, except for having been revived somewhat by Martin Seligman of positive psychology. I suspect that the word has a lot of meaning for you, and maybe you can kind of unpack it for us.
Sure. Let me do my first disclaimer, and that is I didn't pick this title.
Oh, really?
This was a publisher that picked it. Yeah, I had a really hard time coming up with, you know, just that right title, and they wanted to go in this direction, and I thought, well, okay, well, let's give it a shot. So for me, the downside, what this isn't, maybe, is a way to start, and that is the notion of virtues in this case are not commandments or how-tos in any sense of that word. I think of them instead as inner capacities, capacities of our humanity that can be grown and developed, but also in many ways are quite innate. And so for me, these virtues are qualities and capacities that are essential for really, you know, living the good life, what the Greeks originally meant by the good life. It wasn't about lots of bling. It was about lots of, you know, lots of character and lots of bliss and lots of flexibility as well.
Yeah. Do you happen to remember what your original title was going to be?
I think I had half a dozen of them. And one of the subtitles that I liked and still like is A Field Guide to the Inner Life.
That would fit very well. Yeah. Yeah. I like that. You know, somehow I titled the episodes and I had originally planned to, you know, make it Four Virtues with Dr. Tobin Hart, but I felt like there should be something maybe a little more descriptive, and so I want to run this title by you. The one I've come up with is A Plan for Long-Term Life Satisfaction. Hmm. How does that fit?
Yeah, where have you been? You know, I needed these titles early. So, yeah. I think that's nice. I think, you know, originally for me, my wife and I were working on a book that was following the secret spiritual world of children, and we were looking at some way to help develop those natural capacities that children have, but to do them in some way that really honored where they were, but also understood that there's a developmental arc to this sort of inner life. And that sort of had its run, and we decided not to follow up on that. And I picked this up a few years ago to follow up. And then I realized what I was writing for were most of my students, you know, who range from 18 to 80. And also clients, and also my friends and myself in some way. And I really was asking the question, well, what is it that we need to live a life of flourishing and fulfillment? And I noticed that in many cases, the various traditions, both psychological and spiritual, have emphasize one or another, or sometimes more than one, but I really saw these as a matrix, as a kind of balance that was required. And I didn't see that very well in many other traditions or many other writings.
Well, you anticipated one of my questions, which was to ask you who the intended audience for this book is. And you mentioned psychological and spiritual, and this really is a book that is addressing or coming from both of those places and really kind of marries the two in some very nice and very profound ways. Now, writing a book is a lot of work. How long did this take, and what was driving you to write this particular book at this particular time?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, again, I, you know, it's pretty easy to see hunger out there, and that hunger is for something deeper and more sustaining, I think, in our world. And it's particularly, for me, a hunger that begins on the inside and ends on the inside. You know, we certainly want those things on the outside and those ways of being in the world and so forth that are fulfilling. But for me, it really felt like in order to be a match for the reality that is presented these days, we really needed these inner capacities, these inner qualities, these inner virtues in order to really be able to take on and take in the world most fully. So, you know, this has been lingering for a long time. I'm not even sure how long it took to write. It had a couple different iterations. As I said, my wife and I began something many years ago, and then this popped up again and said, you know, I feel like I need to finish this, and I feel like there's some contribution here. And in some ways, I think of this as a little bit of a curriculum, you know, a curriculum for that inner life or psychospiritual development. It sort of laid out that way, and it emerged spontaneously or organically that way for me.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if you use it as a required text, maybe for a course you teach, or that others might do that.
Well, in fact, I have piloted it, on my some master's student guinea pigs in a course called Growth and Potential, and it actually is a for me a nice framework, I think, to explore some of these dimensions.
Yeah, you talked about that sort of inner hunger that we have of searching for something deeper, and actually, that's part of what drives me to do these interviews. That I think characterizes my audience out there, that the people who listen to this series have that hunger and go about filling it in different ways. And Shrink Wrap Radio, I think, becomes part of that, the ability to listen to people such as yourself and find some nourishment. Is there something about the time that we're in right now that lent urgency to getting your message out?
Well, I think that it's easy to find tough times in any age, you know, but there sure is urgency these days, unprecedented peril and also possibility, of course, in these days. And with the advent of instant technology, I think it puts an added opportunity and also an added threat to us. You know, we've already become functioning hybrids. You know, with a flick of a finger, we can access virtually any information. But the issue isn't so much access as it is how do we integrate this? How do we make sense of this? And so for anything that's out there, it requires a big enough and a savvy enough receptor site on the inside for us to really find our resonance with it, to be able to sort the wheat from the chaff, to be able to really see what is of value in this sea of information, right? And those things, to me, are both what's required is both, as we mentioned before, both psychological and spiritual. While these things are often thought of as odd and paradoxical, the psychological develops our will and the spiritual asks us to be willing. The psychological strengthens our sense of self, and the spiritual asks us to be selfless. Psychological helps us differentiate and individuate, and the latter helps us to lose our self-separateness. And so these things are really paradoxical, explicitly. And so part of our challenge, I think, in this age is to figure out what the right balance of those and what the right application, for example, of psychological insight and spiritual wisdom at the same time. And so we've gone off on different threads sometimes and emphasized one or the other, but I really try to bring these together in a very grounded way, I hope.
And indeed you do. I love what you just said about the paradoxes of psychology and spirituality sometimes seemingly pulling us in different directions. In the preface to your book, you describe a pivotal moment when you had been suffering from unbearable angst after having graduated from college, and you discovered by chance a book by Edgar Cayce on your parents' bookcase. Tell us a little bit about the impact of that serendipitous discovery of a book by Edgar Cayce, whom I gather you'd not really heard of before that.
Well, I was a sort of the prototypical lost soul, at that point, and I had all the advantage that anybody should have, and yet I just felt more lost. It was a genuine dark night of the soul for me. We had buried, or rather spread my mother's ashes sometime in the year before, and my dad was living in someplace warmer for the winter, and I had just graduated and went back to his house and just was struggling to make it through the day, and a book seemed to jump off the bookshelf in my very mainstream parents' house, and as you said, it was Edgar Cayce's Story of Karma. And I had remember my mother once trying to share this book with me, when I was 12 or 13, and I was already too sort of dispossessed to have anything to do with it. And so, but in this moment, I opened the page randomly, and it was like an arrow shot at the heart of my longing. And a lot of things might have served this function. I sure was primed for something, for anything, right? So, but this is what did it in that moment. And what it did to me was to open up this possibility that things like suffering and so forth seem to have a kind of inherent meaning in them, and may be a carryover from a previous time or an opportunity to learn some new lesson. And so that was helpful. But part of what it did, part of the turn it made for me, was to really help me to go inward. And so rather than assuming that my solutions were about career or about something on the outside, it was instead directing me toward the inside. And this was really quite profound, alongside this almost unspeakable resonance and epiphany, really, that I had in reading this. I don't know that I ever read very much more of it, although I think I did from time to time, and some of it resonated, some of it didn't. But at this moment, it was clearly one of these sort of conversion experiences, although I wasn't converted to anything. You know, it was a conversion to open inward and to really pursue a path of the inner life.
Yeah, yeah. And to take a tiny step backwards, what was the major you had just graduated from?
Well, it was psychology.
Okay, I was wondering.
Yeah, but it was not a psychology that I got much out of or appreciated very much. Mm-hmm. It just didn't, you know, there wasn't much to it. And yet I knew, still was drawn to that in some way.
You describe another pivotal experience that occurred a couple of years later while hiking in the Adirondacks in upstate New York with a friend. Maybe you can tell us about that one here.
Yeah, my friend Art was initiating me into the high peaks of the Adirondacks, which are 40 peaks above 4,000 feet. And this is a 6-million-acre wilderness, not usually what people think of when they think of New York, but this is up near the Canadian border, and Lake Placid is sort of situated in the middle, if one doesn't know. And so we were hiking, and it was one of these long slogs. We were going up Gothic's Mountain this day, and it was cold, one of these crisp fall days, maybe 35 degrees, lapis blue sky. And we were in the trees for most of the time, and, you know, just plodding along one foot after another. I go through my wine zone, I call it, where it's like, what are we doing? Can't we find something better to do than, this hike? You know, you get to that tired place. And then yeah. finally you get into that meditative rhythm, which is so special. And then we made our, you know, we summited. We went up the sheer rock, the granite face, and got to the top of this mountain. And all of a sudden, something popped. And I started singing the song from The Sound of Music, you know, that song. The hills are alive with tears streaming down the face. I didn't know what else to do. I just was absolutely blown away and felt instantly. I disappeared. I became one with the sky, one with the mountain. And I had, in retrospect, what I didn't know, but what I learned later was this sort of classic, what William James called an oceanic experience. And of course, Maslow talked about this as one form of a peak experience.
Yeah.
And so this just opened up a whole nother another avenue for me on this search. And I fell fast asleep into on the side of this mountain. I'd never slept on a mountain like this before, but it was about an hour later and woke up both more different and more myself than I had ever felt. And this really catalyzed a whole nother pursuit for me of beginning to study this kind of phenomena and this kind of knowing in this place where subject and object collapse into one another. And so that started me toward graduate school and towards a life, really.
So. Yeah, I was really really struck and touched by that story and that experience, and could really see that was a very important kind of launching point for your life, your career, and for this book and the previous one.
Yeah, absolutely. And in some ways, I guess it was a funneling, because it felt like, in retrospect, it feels like, wow, you know, things had always been moving in a certain direction. And sometimes it takes these sort of shocks or momentous moments to really catalyze to another level of it and so forth. So anyway, that's... doesn't always happen that way. That's
right,
the way it
right.
happened for me.
Because sometimes the shock is, you know, that was a transcendent, pleasant, mind-blowing experience. But sometimes the shock is not so pleasant.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, part of our work, I think, is to then try to unpack this, right? To say, well, what's the meaning in this for me? And that's part of what Casey's work did for me, too, is to say, you know, things may or may not be ontologically sort of random, but ultimately, you know, what meaning do we make of this, and how do we use whatever is given as fuel for our fire to move further on?
Yeah. Now, I don't think that's the way Casey put it, but I like what you made of it.
Well, there's always that question of, you know, is meaning inherent in a situation, or do we create it? And
yes.
I always like Viktor Frankl's notion, you know, that ultimately, you know, who knows, but ultimately we have to make our meaning out of what we're given.
Yeah. Yeah, you summarize some of those choices in the last chapter or two of the book in just a way that is so succinct and so beautiful. I think after the interview part is over, I'm going to read a passage to my readers, if you don't mind.
Of course.
Just so that they get a taste of the writing, which I think is just very beautiful, very profound. Now, you describe the four virtues as presence, heart, wisdom, and creation. So maybe you can just kind of give us a bit of an overview of each of these four. Maybe before you do that, actually, though, let me ask you, why these four and not some other list of possible virtues? I could imagine somebody else sitting down to write a book about virtues. They might have come up with a very different list.
Well, and in fact, the ancient lists of virtues in religion and also in philosophy are different than this. And so for me, I tried to do this from the ground up. So it was a question of saying, well, what is it that's important? What is it that really makes a difference in our lives, both at the psychological level, but also from the wisdom traditions? And what are the, you know, what do we know contemporarily from everything from neuroscience to, you know, virtually anything else we can get our hands on? So for me, these four broad categories form a kind of matrix, and I love the etymology of the word matrix. It essentially means mother or womb, and this is the kind of womb, I think, this interiority out of which our life flows, essentially. And for me, Meister Eckhart has this great heretical line. He says, we are meant to be mothers of God. He says, we are meant to be mothers of God. And it's in this matrix, it's from this womb that we generate both our humanity and our divinity all in once. We're meant to be mothers of God. And the most outrageous thing is that we're both the offspring and we're the origin of this. And this is, again, one of these great paradoxical dilemmas. So for me, this is about this inner womb, this inner dynamicism, this vitality out of which our life flows. So,
well, yeah, go ahead.
Sure. No, go ahead, David, if you...
Well, let's drill down deeper into each of these four virtues. Mm-hmm. For example, under the first one, presence,
yeah,
you have sections titled The Beautiful, Sensing, Focusing, Witnessing, and Opening. So let's step through these. We'll see how far we get here.
Sure.
So presence, you know, and I don't. When I think of presence, I don't necessarily think of. Well, having read it, I do now. But the beautiful sensing, focusing, witnessing, opening. So, how does the beautiful relate to? Well, first of all, what do you mean by presence?
Sure. So, each of these four, like directions on the compass, provide certain general capacities. And within each one of these, I've tried to break them down, operationalize them a little bit. So, presence is about this quality that, you know, we hear these days, from mindfulness to being here now, this kind of thing that so many traditions have talked about in one form or another. And so this really allows us to be awake and to show up for whatever comes. And so various practices and woven throughout the book are, at the end of the chapters, are some practices that just a sampling of practices that make this a little more concrete and help lead us in a direction. So presence, again, is about this ability to be awake. And for me, when I looked at these four, I also came to see that the most enduring depictions of human flourishing and fulfillment and the direction for this, we could say, is what the Greeks talked about, is the good and the true and the beautiful. And so for me, it suddenly dawned on me one day, as I had written much of this, that presence for me tied into what I thought of as the beautiful. And the good to heart, and the true to wisdom, and then we added this fourth one, creation or voice or expression. And so for presence, beauty is revealed to the extent that we open to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of knowledge by presence, as the Sufis talked about. And that the extent to which we open to that which is before us is the degree to which it opens to us and is revealed to us. And so while a tree or a painting may have some inherent beauty that we might objectively identify, it is this capacity of presence that actually allows everything to be opened as beautiful. And so that's part of the hinge or the connection that I began to see with these.
Yeah, I get it. If we were fully present, probably everything would be beautiful. I think that's one of the maybe one of the central ideas of Zen. And also I hearken back to psychedelic experiences that I had, and that was a huge piece of it, was a sense of the discovery of sensory beauty all around.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I think because we've sort of shut ourselves up in various caverns of category of what's beautiful and what's not and so forth, it's hard for us to really make contact in that way. So things like, for me, for sensing and focusing and witnessing and opening are four distinct capacities that really engender presence, that help us bring the beautiful, awaken the beautiful really in front of us and within us in some way.
In the section on presence, I love the story that you told about the violinist in the D.C. metro station. Do you remember that?
Yes. In fact, I think it was the Washington Post that placed, I've forgotten who the violinist was. Do you remember?
I don't, but he was a major violinist.
somebody that we both should remember but would recognize. And they placed him in the middle of this as an experiment during rush hour, just to see what would happen, you know, as he plays for 45 minutes. And people just pass by, except a child. And a child stops and rivets his eyes onto this violinist who's playing. And and is basically dragged away by the mom. And over the course of the next 40 minutes or so, the only people, virtually the only people who stop and linger are children, which is very revealing, I think. Now, over the course of this 45 minutes or so, he did make $37. People did put some money in, but they didn't pause at all. And so we just, and by the way, he was playing a violin worth $2.5 million, and he had just played it in Boston the night before at $100 a ticket. And you know, this is one of the greatest violinists in the world, and yet we pass by almost unnoticed. And of course, the point of it for the Washington Post and for this issue of presence was, well, what else do we pass by that we don't notice, and to what extent do we need to be awake to the moment in order for us to gain the nourishment of the beauty in all things.
That's a beautiful story. it's such a cautionary tale in a way.
Exactly.
And you've got lots of great examples throughout the book, stories like that, or references to research or to wisdom literature. So I really want to, I didn't write them all down, so I really want to encourage you to throw in any that come to mind as we move along here.
Sure.
Is there anything more that you want to say about some of the other sort of major sections under presence? We talked about the beautiful. You've got sections on sensing, focusing, where you talk about Eugene Gendlin, and I got to meet Gendlin and was very taken with his approach, witnessing, opening. Oh, another thought that came to mind, aside from Gendlin, I was also very influenced by Jim Buchenthal, therapist who was maybe the first president of the Association of Humanistic Psychology, and who wrote very powerfully, I think, about his approach to therapy. I don't recall if he used the word presence or not. He might have, but I think the concept of presence is really key in psychotherapy in terms of whether or not it really works and gels.
Absolutely, and I think there's sort of two directions of presence, too, right? One of them is what Gendlin is so good still. He's a buddy of one of my current doctoral students, so and he's still active and thinking really well, by the way.
Okay.
And Gendlin's work was, as we know, the audience might not, is on focusing. And for him, the word focusing, David Rome, for example, calls it inner listening. And basically, it's about listening to the body's felt sense. And so so that's one direction, to listen within. And of course, the other, as Jim Buchenthal talks about and others, is to listen without. That is to listen from a deep place within to the other. And as you say, this is just absolutely fundamental. It's what Rogers did, and all the great humanistic therapists, I think, is to really be able to come and make contact and be available for the other. Part of what focusing section and also the sensing section under presence is about pays particular attention to the sensual world, you know, how it resonates with us. And we're beginning to learn, for example, even in neuroscience, how central this sense of felt sense is. For example, we now know that the gut, we've talked about gut feelings for a long time, and our language is imbued with references to body knowing in some ways. But now we've got psychiatrists who are prescribing probiotics for psychiatric conditions like OCD and anxiety. We know that there's a new language being talked about body sensing. It's called the enteric nervous system. The enteric nervous system, which is about the gut as a source, not just of digestion, but of digesting information. That is, it's a knowing center. And the extent to which we can actually integrate these ways of knowing, for example, to rekindle our attention to the sensuality of the world, including our own senses, actually makes for a more robust way of knowing the world.
Well, I had not heard that part about psychiatrists prescribing probiotics. And if you have a reference you can send me after the interview, that would be a good thing for me to follow up on, because I have kind of done a sequence that I hope to put together for CE credit about diet and things like that. And so this, you know, talking to somebody about that would fit right in beautifully. And in the section that that you're kind of describing now, where you talk about the gut sense, I remember that you mentioned Candace Pert and her research. And just synchronistically, just the day before I read that, a friend was telling me all about Candace Pert and the importance of her work, and I didn't know about her, and I'm not sure I remember enough to talk about it, and I don't know if you do or not, but if you can, enlighten us.
Sure. Well, Candace wrote a book called The Molecules of Emotion in the early 80s, and she was a neuroscience researcher, essentially, and she was looking... Well, she found something, and the last place that a neuroscientist would be expected to find it, and that is she found basically neuropeptides and the receptor sites, which are associated with cognition, and we find them in the brain. But she found these neuropeptides in the gut. And so what she essentially concluded was that if those are in the gut, and we know that they're about cognition, about thought, essentially, is the gut capable of thinking? And so, as she said, she can no longer make any meaningful distinction between the body and the brain, essentially. And there is this very much sort of full-bodied knowing, essentially, that she began to understand and really sort of launched this whole direction of understanding the gut and other parts of the body as sentient in some way.
And so this sort of reinforces, you know, a lot of people have for a long time, I was one of them, felt that bodily approaches to psychotherapy were important. This would seem to help buttress that notion.
Absolutely. From Wilhelm Reich, whose son, actually, I lived next to his son in Massachusetts for a number of years, about 8 years.
Really?
Yeah, he's a nice guy. And so from Reich to Lowen to Perakis to Ida Rolf to all the somatic psychotherapists, including Ron Kurtz's Hakomi therapy and Fritz Perl's Gestalt and so forth, that we really have come to understand, I think, much better that a somatic understanding of issues is central, and that like any good, one of the things that psychotherapists sometimes make the mistake of doing is assuming, because of their, you know, our particular bias, is that we assume things are psychological, and in some cases they absolutely are. But in some cases, like a good physician, the first thing is to say, okay, well, have you had a physical? And, you know, what's going on at the physical level? And this is why really attuning to how the body is operating, particularly with things like the gut, can be dramatically influential in our psychological state.
Well, moving along, you know, speaking of somatic, the next virtue that you discuss is heart, although you weren't speaking of it somatically, and your last name sounds the same as well, I have to note, but it's spelled differently. And in fact, we have learned a lot about the heart somatically and how it ties in to some of the psychological processes. I don't know that you go on about that in your book, but have you been following any of that?
Sure. There's good folks at HeartMath, for example, have done a really commendable job of putting energy cardiology on the legitimate scientific map. And I hope I have mentioned it in there in one form or another. In fact, I think I have. Absolutely, just as the gut is and the brain are sources of knowing, the heart certainly is too. And so in this big section with the heart, and of course, you know, we know across all traditions through all time, the heart is both the path and the end goal for a life well lived. And yet so much has been written about love and the heart and so forth that you know, from every poet and great songwriter and philosopher in many ways have tried to circle this territory. And so what I've tried to do is, you know, also the impossible, and that is to operationalize what we mean by heart. And mm-hmm. and so essentially I say that it is the foundation. When we talk about the heart, we're talking about the foundation for the good. And for me, I see four key capacities, four key dimensions, each of which can be assessed and developed, and each of which is both psychological and spiritual. And so these are compassion, which is quite a natural state, even among young children. That's one of the things I discovered in looking at the spiritual life of kids. Empathy and empathizing. So this ability is, you know, the word empathy from German means feeling into. And so it's a way of knowing that is resonant, where we literally are in a frequency lock with the other. And of course, these days we're hearing about things like mirror neurons that give some neurobiological validity mm-hmm. to what we know, what's been around for a long time. The third dimension is, besides compassion and empathizing, is feeling. And so this is sort of obvious, but we don't always know what to do with those feelings. Often we preference some feelings over other. Obviously, we want to feel happy instead of jealous. But the work is exactly and precisely to befriend all of what's there. Otherwise, we develop, as Jung says, this shadow. And then the last one is connecting, and it's about heart is about so much about how we live always as a self in relation and how we connect with others.
Okay. Are there any good stories that you recall from that section on heart?
I remember this old Hasidic story that I think Martin Buber tells about this fellow who comes up to this famous rabbi, and he says, if you can tell me what the meaning of the Torah is while standing on one foot, I'll convert. And so apparently standing on one foot, the rabbi says, basically do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And it is essentially this notion of the golden rule, and it's also called the law of reciprocity. And it is this power, you know, this notion of always being in alignment with or in consideration of the other in some way. And this is comes out of the heart of compassion and mm-hmm. is applied in the feeling world of empathy, and ultimately makes us connect. So this is, you know, we know, for example, even psychologically that empathy, for example, is the heart of morality. No matter what sort of commandments or rules are around, ultimately it's the degree to which we can bring our heart to this meeting with the planet, with a person that will determine how we act towards it.
Wonderful. Well, the third section is wisdom, and you have sections on the true, possibility, guidance, clarifying, and discerning. So how are these components of wisdom?
Well, for me, this was a little different. Of course, in many traditions, the good and the true, or heart and wisdom, or compassion and wisdom are recognized as the dynamic duo, you know, that will lead us to the next step spiritually. For me, I tried to unpack wisdom a little bit. It is a funny thing, right? It's this thing Aquinas says that it involves nome, and nome means being able to see into the heart of something, or seeing things from a greater height. And so this capacity of wisdom, of sorting out what is true from what's not, involves a particular quality of knowing. It's also not something that we accumulate as if wisdom were a thing. Instead, we act wisely or not. So it's this living virtue, it's this living capacity that requires our presence and our heart in every moment to decide whether what the wise thing is to do in this moment. And that's why, that's why there isn't a list of things that are wise to do. You know, it may be smart or may not be, but essentially it is this living quality that sometimes we mistake for a thing.
I'm interested in guidance, which is one of the things that you talk about here. Tell us a bit about the role of guidance. And by the way, that was one of the things that really struck me was towards the end, you say something to the effect of one striving not to be wise, but to act wisely.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just such a compact statement, but it really made an impact on me.
Yeah, so you know, we fall prey to, you know, sort of striving and hubris, I think, if we think we're wise, you know, because yeah. Any situation can present itself and it's this question of, wow, okay, can I bring my presence and my heart to this moment in order to see from a greater height or see into the heart of the thing, as Aquinas says. And yeah, you know, this is this very delicate living balance, I think. So guidance... we ask all sorts of things. You know, we go from tax talk to car talk when we need wise guidance on things. And so we may find those wise souls outside us. So that's one source of guidance. We may also find guidance in the form of values. So not what somebody else's values are, but what values really ring to you. And there's a little exercise in which we're invited to think of three people that we admire and what those qualities are that they possess and to what extent do we live up to those. That is, to what extent do we see those qualities within us? And those are often a kind of a sneaky way to assess our own values. And so that's a way of seeking guidance, to sort of imagine ourselves aligning our choices with that. But then another source is, of course, this deep center that's both within and without somehow, where we, the ancient Greeks, for example, Hesiod, the first offering or the first writing of the word inspiration was in Hesiod's Theogony. And he says, "Sing in me, muse, and through me tell the story." And so it is this sort of call, this invocation to something both deep within us and maybe beyond us, in which we look for some kind of source, some kind of clue, some kind of hint, some kind of symbol that we may be able to find a path. A step on the path. But.
You know, some people refer to their spirit guides, and I notice that as you talk about this, you're very careful and to keep open the possibility that it's coming from without. Can you say a little bit about that? Because I always wrestle with that a little bit. You know, I don't have that experience of spirit guides, and yet as I look at my life, I feel like there's been some guidance there that I wasn't particularly aware of, but there's too much of a pattern and a kind of a meaningful pattern for me to totally discount in a rational way.
Well, and I do think that's where both the phenomenology of psychology and also the source of spirituality really comes in, where you know, we just don't know, you know, that for us to stay alive to the mysterious is not naivete, I think. It's actually profound wisdom. And I too, you know, feel like, you know, anything is maybe speaking to us. You know, we just don't know how this thing called consciousness or the world works. And so, you know, it's just as reasonable a story, I think, in many cases to say, oh, well, you know, I heard this voice and it told me this, as opposed to, you know, some part of me was talking to another part of me. I just don't think consciousness is confined to the brain. Of course, we've talked about the heart and the gut already, but it's probably not confined to our body either. And so we've got lots of evidence from very credible accounts of past life memories, from Ian Stevenson, the University of Virginia medical school professor, to all kinds of other accounts of near-death experiences, where we understand that those things that we think are solid and secure and live just within us may exist outside of our body as well. So certainly the great prophets of all times have recognized, or at least gave credit to, something beyond themselves. My doctoral dissertation happened to be on the experience of inspiration and its role in healthy functioning. And one of the things I looked at, both spiritually and also psychologically, was this notion of this experience of getting something from somewhere else, or at least it seemed that way. So we only have to look at any act of creativity, or most acts of creativity, where folks experience the phenomenological experience is that, wow, I just saw the whole symphony light up like a landscape at a lightning strike. That's Tchaikovsky talking about his inspiration, for example, for writing music. So we get this sense of something outside us a lot of times.
Yeah, and of course I'm wondering where you did that doctoral dissertation, because there aren't a lot of places where you could do that.
Well, that was at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst some time ago, and at that time there was a really viable sort of transpersonal and creativity and humanistic program.
Wow, I wasn't aware of that. Well, good for them. Well, we get to the last virtue, which you characterize as creation. And, boy, that sounds like God, you know, the God is the creator. What are you talking about here?
Well, again, back to Eckhart, right? We're meant to be mothers of God, he says. So for me, this is the fourth direction on this compass, and these things really fit together for me. And so one might have a great presence, they might have great heart, they might have even a great sense of wisdom, how to act wisely in given situations. But there's one more thing that's required of us. Emerson, for example, in his diaries, he said, when you've arrived here, you are in that place to testify. And so who knows exactly what he meant by that, but for me, what that meant was that this is a place where you need to bring your creative juice into the world. Mm-hmm. And so I use the word voice in this case. And yes, by voice, I mean your unique creative expression in the world. So it might be literally writing a book, or it might be the way that you make that souffle, or it might be the particular quality of your skateboarding, or it might be the way that you raise your child. It's whatever that creative expression in. It's identity is self-sculpture in some way. And so each of those things is totally unique to us, and it requires a particular attunement, I think, to our own originality, and also to this adventure, as Whitehead talks about. One of his qualities of being is the sense of adventure. And in order to feel that, we have to be able to bring our life force out. It's a great line from the Nag Hammadi Library, the Gospel of St. Thomas, and it says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. And Maslow actually said something quite similar. I'm not able to pull up his that reference in my mind right now, but something very similar. He said, look, you got to be able to express yourself creatively out there, not by anybody else's standards, but by your own. You have to find your voice. You have to express it in the world. And for me, a lot of times we're not sure what next step to take. Or with our clients or our loved ones or our friends, what next step to take. And part of what I've tried to do in this book is to say, okay, you may have great heart, but not necessarily great capacity for discernment, and so which is in what I think of as wisdom. And so you may spend your heart in ways that lead to burnout, or you may have a great sense of presence and a great sense of heart, but not yet found a creative expression in the world. And so things have, will back up and clot your consciousness. And so it's these the balance of these four, you know, each in our own unique particular ways that form the possibility for this flourishing and fulfillment, is my argument, at least.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and Freud argued that it was sort of a pent-up, dammed-up, denied sexuality that led to neuroses. And yeah. It occurred to me independently, I must admit, because I wasn't so widely read, that creativity might also, that blocked, dammed-up creativity might also lead to a bad result. And so, in part, I think that's kind of what you're saying here.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly the case. And again, creativity doesn't have to be, you know, becoming a great painter or a furniture maker. It's just in the quality of our being, you know, how we live our life in any way and what we bring into the world.
And it seems to me that part of what your call to action is here under creation is this kind of foundational for activism in the world.
Yeah, I think it is too. And in fact, the last chapter is about calling. And, you know, it's that place where, I'll borrow a quote here, but it's that place where our deep gladness meets the world's great need. And our calling is composed of two different functions, I think. And one of them is what it is that we have to offer the world. That's just our particular unique way of doing that. But the other is what is it that we have to learn, and that these things together really blend and serve each other. So calling isn't just about, you know, being some martyr for some cause necessarily. It is that place where we can find real joy, and not just happiness, oh, that feels good, but this really profound joy that ultimately I think we're all sort of hungry for and searching for.
Yeah, indeed. Hey, do you have another book you're working on?
I do, actually. It's just gone off to the publisher, and it is called The Integrative Mind, Transformative Education for a World on Fire. And it takes some of these very same principles, but it essentially is saying, it's essentially written for education, especially, and feeling as though that's one of the places where we are absolutely stuck.
Yeah.
And so what it argues for is a way of knowing rather than a set of knowledge. And that way of knowing is a shift from the kind of objectivist, modernist approach to one that incorporates a more integrative and participative kind of knowledge. And anyway, so maybe we'll talk about that.
Yeah, there's a good chance that we will talk about that down the line. As we wrap up here, I wonder if there are any final words you want to, anything you want to say, anything we didn't touch on that maybe you'd like to get out?
The book has a website, and the website is thefourvirtues.org and com and net, I think.
Oh, you got them all. Okay.
Yeah. And on the website, it's some summary of the book and so forth. But also what will be up there, and it should be already, but it will be, I think, just within a few days. One of the features of the book is that it actually has a series of little quizzes throughout. And these are, you know, sometimes we think of these as just little cute things, but they're a way of a kind of reflecting on our own state and our own strengths. And on the website will be a self-scoring sort of comprehensive quiz. Somebody can just go in and for free, they can just spend several minutes, and it will give a plot of each of these 16 different dimensions that are within this, and it provides a kind of trailhead for growth for folks.
Okay, well, this has been wonderful to have the chance to talk to you again, and so Dr. Tobin Hart, I really want to thank you for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's my pleasure.
I think many of you will agree with me that this will be yet another very memorable interview with Dr. Tobin Hart. Even though the title of his book, The Four Virtues, might sound like it might be a bit preachy, it's not. One of the things I really admire about his presentation and his way of being in the world is that he is not at all dogmatic. Rather, he points at a number of time-tested ideas and practices that are likely to stand one in good stead in this journey of life. This is a 300-page book, so even though I led him through the main bones of it, we really only scratched the surface. There is so much wisdom and also science. I was blown away in our interview by the ease with which he is able to speak about profound issues of the soul in an impromptu format such as this interview. There's not a big gap between the way he expresses himself in speaking and writing. Both are clear, wise, and down to earth. Let me give you a sample by reading a few paragraphs from page 309, where he is discussing the idea of one's calling, and I quote, "I see three general ways that we try to make sense of this question of direction or calling. The first is the acorn theory. The acorn already has within it the programming for what it is to be, and given the right conditions, it will grow over time into a big oak. Applied to us, the acorn theory implies not only that our DNA predisposes us toward a certain height and hair color, but our soul's code, as psychologist James Hillman calls it, has a message for us to hear and follow about our calling. We can make sense of this as a gift from the divine or as a duty to fulfill or perhaps as the consequence of karma, some seed sown in a previous life. Whatever the source, the notion is that we are already programmed towards certain directions. Our work is to hear that call and live it out in order, we might say, to make our life come true. The second idea has to do with chance. The ancients thought the fates might be playing with us, that the gods spun the wheel of fortune to see what our lot would be. This implies not so much that we have a calling to fulfill, but that life is a roll of the dice. Today we think less about the fates and more about statistical probability, random chance, or just plain luck. Through this lens, our lot is largely beyond our ability to control or direct it very much. Stuff happens. What will we do with what we're given? The third idea is that this is our life to choose. We have free will and agency to be able to imagine and create the life we will. Whether or not we get out of bed in the morning and brush our teeth is our choice. Even how we feel about our day ahead or the diagnosis of disease we've been given may be our choice in the sense that the meaning we make of something can shape our thoughts, feelings, health, and actions. Based on how our wise friends described their own experiences, and taking into account that the theme of integration that is present throughout this book, let's consider calling as a mixture of seed, that which is already within us, circumstance, the life and the situation that's given, and choice, what we commit to and create with what we're given. Close quote. Well, I'm not sure my reading did justice to this passage, but I just love the economy with which he presents these three big alternative ideas, and then integrates them rather than leaving them mutually exclusive choices. If you decide to order Dr. Hart's book, which I heartily recommend, let me remind you to use the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site.
Hi, Dave. This is Ofer calling from neighboring of Petaluma in Northern California, and I am the director of the Zur Institute, and I would like to share my deep, deep appreciation to your lively, informative, educational interviews. I want to let you know, not only we have used so many of them in our online courses for continuing education for mental health professionals, when I am on the treadmill, I just put my Bluetooth and connect to any of your interview at random. And sometimes I find myself, oh my goodness, an hour later, I'm still on the treadmill, because I am so engulfed and mesmerized and engaged with listening to your live interviews. So thank you for providing such a fantastic resource to therapists, to educators, to the general public. So I can't wait to hear your next interview. And as you know, I'm not giving compliments very easily. And you'll be the first one to know that. So this is really, real appreciation from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Ofer Zur, clinical psychologist and founder/director of the Zur Institute and guest on episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio number 273 and number 287. I'm so glad to hear we're keeping company during your workouts on the treadmill. Just goes to show that Shrink Wrap Radio builds not only strong minds, but strong bodies. By making it possible for us to put together selected interviews into continuing education packages offered through the Zur Institute, Ofer is contributing to the financial support of our efforts, and he encourages you to join in that effort as well. Thanks to one of our other CE providers, Ed4 Online, we have four new transcripts on the site. They are number 318, Understanding Problem Kids with Nancy Rappaport, MD, number 353, Thriving with Adult ADHD with Craig Sorman, MD, number 389, The Brain Bible with John B. Arden, PhD, and number 322, Mastering Resilience with Dennis Charney, MD. You may recall that Ed4 Online offers continuing education for vocational training. You can find a number of their one-unit courses featuring Shrink Wrap Radio interviews, as well as other courses. You'll find a link to them in the left-hand sidebar of our site. They've given us these four transcripts at no cost, so a big thank you to Ed4 Online. Also, don't forget about the International Association for the Study of Dreams Conference in Berkeley, California, running June 4 through the 8th of 2014. It's open to all, and I hope to see you there. Click on the link in the left-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com for full details and registration.
Hi, this is Jules from the Sunshine Coast, Queensland, Australia, and you're hanging out with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Jules of the Sunshine Coast of Australia, and I hope you're still hanging out with Dr. Dave. Let's go to the email bag for a couple of recent communiques from our Shrink Wrap Radio community. First, we hear from Kathy, who replied to my thanks for her donation. And Kathy writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Thanks so much for providing such enriching content on Shrink Wrap Radio. I've been listening for years, and it never gets dull. It only gets better. Unlike many of your listeners, I'm not in the psychology field, but got a degree in electrical engineering back in the 80s. I've often wondered how it would have turned out if I'd studied psychology instead of circuits. I'm especially taken with Jungian psychology, no surprise since I've been recording my dreams for some 25-plus years. Jung's Man and His Symbols launched me on that trajectory again back in the 80s. Your interviews have helped me understand how to interpret my dreams and pointed me to resources such as books that I might not have learned of on my own. I'd love to endorse you via audio if only I felt comfortable doing that. I'm one of those people that expresses herself much better in writing than speaking, so I think I'll make my case via email. I'd like to say to your audience that I feel my $50 each year is a small price to pay for access to such a wealth of knowledge, given so freely by both yourself and your guests in a truly enjoyable and convenient format. I look forward to your new interviews, and I hate to even think of these ever going away due to lack of resources or perception that they're not appreciated for they are and by so many. Because I have a gazillion things vying for my attention, and I think of you so highly, I've put a yearly reminder on my calendar to donate. Hey, I love that idea. I would encourage your other listeners to do the same. That makes it easy to consume all your hard work and good conscience, or they can do once a month option you offer, another no-brainer. When I thought of all the other things in life that I wouldn't hesitate to spend $50 on, I just had to add you to the list. I've listened to a lot of podcast series, and yours is one of the few that has captured and kept my interest for the duration. Thanks so much for your hard work and your enthusiasm for education. You're a gem. Sincerely, Kathy. Well, Kathy, you are a gem yourself, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate your dedication and your great idea of putting the donation on the calendar. And that's a great suggestion for others to follow. And I'll do my best to hang in there and keep this content coming your way. Similarly, Jacinda sends the following note along with her donation. And she writes, "Thank you. Really enjoying being able to listen to these podcasts when out walking or working in the garden. It's a great way to keep up with psychology and maintain my health and garden, too." And that's from Jacinda. And I always love to hear, Jacinda, how and where people are listening. So thanks for sharing with us. And once again, that'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our message phone at 206-309-4707. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Dr. Tobin Hart for his sage observations on cultivating the inner life. Be sure to listen next time when my guest will be Dr. Pat Ogden, and we'll be discussing her work on trauma and the body. She's one of the leading lights on the sensory-motor approach to psychotherapy. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.